Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The Agriculture Department has in the pipeline right now several new rules to promote transparency and fairness in livestock marketing.
As these rules are being rolled out, we want to make sure that folks understand and appreciate that we expect them to be enforced.
And Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says that goes for rules already on the books. And so to that end,
we're beginning a process that will lead to the appointment of a chief competition officer at USDA. This is an individual whose job will be primarily to reinforce our policy development in this space, make sure that enforcements are taking place as they should, and to work as a career liaison to other federal agencies that are engaged and involved with us in enforcement.
Vilsack said this new enforcement position will not be filled by a political appointee that would change with every administration, but rather a career government employee. Gary Crawford, Washington.
This is Agriculture Today.
The latest World Agricultural Supply and Demand Report from USDA increased yield for both corn and soybeans. Betty Resnick, American Farm Bureau Federation economist, says the report comes as harvest is wrapping up across the country.
As of November 5th, which is our latest crop progress report, corn is at 81% harvested nationwide, and soybeans are at 91% harvested nationwide. So we're definitely wrapping up both of those, and both are slightly above five-year averages. We've had pretty good harvest conditions. However, they have been battling some pretty wet conditions in Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. They're a bit behind schedule, but overall, we've made really good progress in harvest this year.
Resnick says the WASDE report with increased yields reflects the resiliency of the corn crop this year.
We were facing really potentially desperate situations earlier this summer with drought. They've revised yields back up 1.9 bushels to 174.9 bushels nationally, putting us back on track for a record corn crop. So corn's gotten bigger. We're going to see loosening supplies with that. And soybeans, similar story. They also saw a bump up in yields to 49.9 bushels an acre.
With harvest nearing its end, attention now turns to South America.
As Northern Hemisphere harvest wraps up, of course, all eyes are starting to go south of the equator to see what's going on in South America as they start planting again, what that's going to look like for global supply. But I really think one of the stories of this season in general is corn's resilience.
Michael Clements, Washington.
Now, Kansas State University grain economist Dan O'Brien looks at the cotton numbers.
Cotton numbers came out and showed the production figures actually were a little bit higher, but what stands out to cotton growers is some deterioration in market price prospects, at least for the national average price. We took about 3 cents a pound off of that from the USDA's projection down to 77 cents. We were at about 84.8 cents last year. So in some of these same areas where we're growing cotton, it's also awfully dry. And of course, cotton's a very drought tolerant crop. It holds up well. But if yields are just so, then one way to overcome poor yields in production would be good prices. But it seems that we've just got a moderate situation to slightly declining now for cotton as opposed to a stronger market, which most of our good ag producers would like to have happen.
But eyes are starting to turn to wheat.
Yeah, winter wheat seedings, here we are, mid-November. The percentage planted for the Kansas crop is, as you'd expect, about 96%. There's probably some on the edges that may still be planted in different parts. And emergence rated at, if we're 96% planted, emergence at 81%, and that's a little bit above average, so that's okay. But our condition ratings, in terms of the amount, very poor, poor, fair, good, and excellent, pretty startling for the Kansas crop. And these numbers that have come out here this week, earlier this week, and we've had no rain since then, you have 16% of the Kansas wheat crop, and it's this very early condition at very poor, 18% at poor, only 35% at fair, and then for good to excellent, you've got 28 and 3, so about 31%. And there's some other states that also aren't doing very well that are around us. Oklahoma, 4% very poor, 12% poor. Texas, 8% very poor, 11% poor. But again, we're in an unenviable position of having the worst rating out of these three states, heading from Kansas to Oklahoma to Texas in terms of this wheat crop. And people are anxiously awaiting any word of a chance when rain will come. And really, it's important now to get that wheat emerge, get it a stand, et cetera, to be in decent shape before winter freezes come and all of that. So pretty critical time for the wheat crop, even though it's so early in the cropping cycle.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The definition of livestock can vary depending on for what purpose we need the definition for. Washburn University law professor Roger McOwen. For example, there are certain instances in the tax code where bees count as livestock, poultry count as livestock, but yet for other definitions in the tax code, other purposes of the tax code, bees and poultry, for example, don't count. Bees would be insects, and they don't count as livestock. And what I mean by this is there are favorable rules in certain situations that apply to livestock, and if what we're talking about doesn't qualify as livestock, then you can't take advantage of those rules.
But why are definitions really that important?
Semen is wannabe livestock. That's not livestock yet. And so we often think of that with respect to security agreements. When if I'm a lender and I want to take an interest in a farmer's collateral and I'm defining it as livestock and so forth, well, the semen's not going to be picked up in that. I have to specifically state that. And that can be a big issue depending on what that farmer is doing. Maybe they're doing artificial insemination, which, by the way, is what I thought AI always referred to. Now that refers to something else that I had. I was totally caught off guard by that. I did see a flyer at the law school. We were having an AI symposium. And I thought, well, wait a minute, why wasn't I invited to this? We're talking about artificial insemination, and some of the other professors looked at me like I was from Mars. What? It's artificial intelligence. I said, well, okay, we're talking we got two different worlds going on here. In ag, that's artificial insemination. But if our client, if we're a lender to a farm client that is engaged in providing breeding services, well, then we want to retool our security agreement financing statement to say livestock products thereof and unborn young of livestock, including semen. We need to be specific as well as general. So it makes a difference in a number of areas of the law that we often don't think about, whether we're talking tax, whether we're talking zoning ordinances, whether we're talking a security agreement. Yeah, draft broadly. What I like to tell lawyers is draft broadly, but then be specific so that you catch it.
McCowan also talks about veterinarians and liens.
The veterinarian can get a lien for their services that they haven't been paid for. So a farmer goes or a livestock owner goes to a veterinarian, has services rendered for an animal or for their livestock herd, and or the vet comes out to the farm or the ranch, renders the services, and if they don't get paid, the vet has a lien that they can ultimately enforce, and they can levy on some of the other assets of that farmer or garnish wages or something to satisfy the lien. The interesting thing about a lien, and the important thing about a lien, is that it has priority status over a prior perfected secured lender. So if the farmer has already pledged the cattle, for example, if it's cattle that were being treated by the veterinarian, if they've already been pledged as collateral on a loan to the primary lender of that farmer, say a bank, and a vet provides services that weren't paid for, the vet's lien will outstrip, will come first before the bank if it's properly perfected. And you have to file to get super priority status. We had a recent case in Kansas where a vet did provide services, tried to assert his lien, but it was such a weird set of facts. He didn't know who actually brought the livestock to his office. He had worked on them in the past. He knew whose animals they were, but there was no note. They just showed up in a trailer, and so he cared for them for a period of time and ultimately wanted to get paid, and the owner of the livestock said, well, I didn't take them there. I don't know who did. There were a bunch of funny things going on in this situation. The long story short, he wasn't able to enforce his lien because he couldn't prove that the owner requested his services. But the key point on this is if you have a lien for your services, the vet lien, that will come before a prior perfected security interest if it's properly perfected.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We explore the new export routes for Ukrainian grain since the Black Sea Grain Initiative expired in July 2023. Also, the impact of the war on Ukrainians' agriculture since the beginning of the conflict almost 2 years ago.
University of Illinois ag economist Joanna Calusi.
Ukraine is one of the main world exporters of grains and vegetables oils. The main agriculture export products are corn and wheat. In 2021, before the war, Ukraine was the second largest supplier of grains for the European Union and a large food supplier for low and mid-income countries in Asia and Africa. You can see the war's negative impacts on Ukraine's corn production and exports in this chart. In 2022-2023 crop season, the corn production declined by 20% compared to the last five-year average. Corn exports reached 28 million tons in 2022, a 90% increase compared to the pre-war levels. It was possible due to a large beginning stocks and the availability of new and more efficient grain export routes established through the Black Sea Grain Initiative in July 2022. Now, let's take a look in the numbers regarding wheat production and exports. In 2022-2023 crop season, the wheat production declined by 23% compared to the pre-war levels. In this period, Ukraine exported 17 million metric tons, 5% less compared to the five-year average. Despite very pessimistic projections for grain exports after the invasion, exports have been much stronger than expected. Now, looking into the future, the situation can get worse. Ukraine's exports of corn in 2023-2024 market year are projected to decline 24% compared with pre-war levels. Meanwhile, the Ukraine exports of wheat are projected to decline 39%. Such a significant downgrade in export projections is explained by the loss of export routes since July of 2023 when Russia pulled up of the Black Sea Grain Initiative. Since the end of the agreement, Ukrainian grain exports have relied mainly on the Danube River. That helped move about 65% of all grain in the first 2 months of 2023-2024 market year. Before the war, only 4% of all Ukrainian grain exports were shipped through these ports. In addition, the importance of the new established humanitarian grain corridor in the Black Sea, protected by the Ukrainian military, is growing and expect to allow Ukraine to ship up to 1.1 million metric tons monthly. Meanwhile, farmers are waiting to see how domestic prices will respond to these new routes to finalize plans for the next planting season in 2024.
University of Illinois ag economist Joanna Colucci. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Well, I think what we're likely going to see is an extension.
Representative Rick Crawford from Arkansas is a member of the House Ag Committee.
What I'm advocating for, and I think many members are, is a one-year extension that gets us through December of 24. That's not to say that we're not going to get a farm bill done between now and then. What that means is we start the year knowing where we finish the year. That is to say we need to maintain some degree of continuity, and if we can do that with the current construct through a one-year extension, that I think will serve producers better because we're going to start the year. We're wrapping up harvest right now. It won't be long before our producers are going back to the banks, and the banks are making those operating loans, and they're going to need to know, that we're all singing from the same hymnal. So I think that's important to extend that out for a full year. That said, we will probably get the farm bill done and USDA reauthorized in the first quarter of next year, which would then supersede the extension. But what that means, though, is that at least we're providing a degree of certainty with a one-year extension.
One area the farm bill does not address, the issue of interest.
It's been absolutely been a concern. It has been for a couple of years. You know, we went, in 2021, we started obviously seeing the signs of those interest rates starting to increase. And so farmers starting that year, you could absorb a 1% increase in interest rates, a 2% increase in interest rates. But the reality is even a 2% interest rate increase in 2021 was essentially doubling the cost of money because we had been paying, very low interest rates for an extended period of time. Now, granted, you know, we also were seeing, you know, commodity prices in the tank for an extended period as well. So not necessarily a fair trade. But then what we saw was we saw another doubling of interest rates year over year. So we went from a 4.5% interest rate to some of those farm loans were being now at the 9% interest rate in some cases. And so it made it that much more expensive, combined with inflation that was driving input costs through the roof, and those conditions persist. And so what we can't do in a farm bill is bring interest rates down. What we can't do in a farm bill is to, you know, make inflation go away. But what we can do is try to provide some degree of certainty for producers, and that is knowing, yes, the cost of money has gone up. Yes, input costs have increased. But at least we know that we're still making those production loans under the same programs that we have done for the last several years. And so there's at least a certain degree of continuity with respect to those programs.
Crawford has been spearheading an effort in the House for ag worker reforms. Will it pick up steam in the Senate?
Well, we think so. I mean, obviously, because we're taking such a narrow focus on this as it applies to ag labor, and we have deliberately steered clear of the immigration part of it, because anytime you put comprehensive in front of an effort, it usually dooms the effort. So we've deliberately taken a very targeted approach to how we address this problem. And we think, based on the feedback that we're getting, that it's actually making a difference. We're hearing that from our colleagues on both sides of the aisle. This has been a very good bipartisan effort, and we think we can get some bicameral uptake as well. So I think the approach has been appropriate. I think we're going to see a really good opportunity for the first time to actually affect some positive change.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
USDA recently announced disaster-related funding for events that occurred in 2022 through the Emergency Relief Program. American Farm Bureau Federation economist Danny Munch explains.
The new ERP program is a continuation of the previous ERP, which covered qualifying losses from 2021 and 2020. This new one will add an additional $3.74 billion in ad hoc assistance for disasters that occurred in 2022.
The application process includes two separate tracks for farmers.
Track one is going to be for farmers who already have had an active crop insurance plan in 2022 or an active NAP plan in 2022. So those folks will receive a pre-filled application with their information. Just because you receive a pre-filled application doesn't mean you'll get payments. You still have to qualify. Track two will cover all other folks, and that's going to use a benchmark revenue from your farm and compare it to your disaster year, either from your tax returns or an expected revenue.
However, the payment formula, Munch says, may be problematic for many farmers.
It looks at your original coverage level in your crop insurance plan, and it bumps it up. So for instance, if you had 55% coverage level, now you have 80. The new piece is it takes that base payment, and then it uses what's called progressive factoring, where the first $2,000, you'll get to keep all of that. The next $2,000 is decreased by 20%, the next 40%. Once you get over $10,000, everything after that is reduced by 90%. And that's a big impact because a lot of farmers that face disasters have losses much higher than $10,000.
Michael Clements, Washington.
So when's the deadline? John Burge, Acting Deputy Administrator for Farm Programs at USDA.
So as of right now, there is no application deadline, and I don't anticipate that there will be for some time. In terms of needing an appointment, no. I think that folks can go in. Part of the hope here was in getting this announced early, even prior to the pre-filled applications going out, was to ensure that people knew that they could just come into the office, meet with their local county staff, and have a discussion with them so that they could pull up the records and see what information was there.
From ERP to ERC, the Employer Retention Credit, Roger McCohen with Washburn University.
The Employee Retention Credit is just riddled with fraud. In fact, it's gotten so bad that the IRS announced in September that they were going to stop processing claims for the fourth quarter of 2023. And so it's just put a halt on everything. And even those people that had valid claims, they can't get their claims processed. So these small businesses that had a valid claim aren't going to get their credit, which they need at this point in time. Now this, again, was all virus-related legislation, and it's put together quickly, and the scammers have jumped all over it. What IRS has said now, and frankly, with respect to farms, farmers may have been misled that they're eligible for this. I don't think there's going to be very many farmers that are, because you had to show a 20% reduction in revenue. Well, during virus-related years and the government shutdowns that were mandated, farmers didn't have a drop in revenue. In fact, the revenue may have gone up, but they may have been coached into filing a claim by these mills that are cranking out these ERC claims fraudulently. And so what IRS has said now is, okay, we're stopping processing the claims until we can get our arms around this mess, and we're going to provide amnesty. And so if you think that you submitted a fraudulent claim, you can withdraw that. There's a procedure for withdrawing it. If you're currently under audit, you can request withdrawal to the auditor and back out, no questions asked. If you've received a refund check and you haven't cashed it yet, you can send it back with a note on it saying that you're withdrawing your claim. No questions asked. You're out. No penalties. Nothing. So in my article that I've written, I've shown what the steps that you need to do and what you have to file to get that.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
You know, we've got producers feeding a whole range of different things this year, so it's important to know, you know, if you're a drought situation and feeding something different, very important to be testing what that feed is and figure out how much energy and protein it maybe is needed in supplementation of what your base forage is.
Dr. Sandy Johnson's a beef reproduction specialist at Kansas State.
That's still true for producers that are feeding their quote-unquote normal feedstuff, because there's not any guarantee that they have the same nutrient density every year. And we need to account for some of that variability. And so we want to test those feedstuffs and make a plan for that cow gain. And the importance of doing it timely, I use the example of if a cow is thin, and she needs to gain the weight of pregnancy plus a body condition score. Say she's a 4, we want to get her up to a 5. So she needs 150 pounds of pregnancy and 80 pounds more to bring up her body condition. So we've got 230 pounds of gain. If we give ourselves 100 days to do that, that's only 2.3 pounds a day. But as we start, if we give ourselves less than that, then the gain we need goes up much higher. And if you just think about a growing calf, the quality of the diet to get a higher gain is higher and more expensive, essentially, to get that higher rate of gain. Well, we would like to make that change in those cows if they need it as inexpensively as possible. And this is where planning can save producers a lot of money, so they're not trying to gain this 30 days before calving, because it's, you know, straight corn diet. If you really had thin cows, it just becomes really out of the reach of most people. So a little bit of planning gets our cows in the body condition score we need, as well as saves money. And this is particularly true then for our first calf heifers, because on top of the body condition, you know, they may be in okay body condition, but they're still growing. So we have these huge nutrient demands that come in this third trimester, and planning helps us manage the cost and deliver the nutrients effectively.
Now, Paul Beck is an extension beef nutrition specialist with Oklahoma State on crossing beef and dairy cattle genetics.
The dairy industry has had a lot of economic issues that have pushed them to adopt some different reproductive technologies so that they can get full-blood replacement heifers out of their very best cows. When we put these beef-on-dairy calves directly on feed at a very light body weight, we're seeing them be on feed for nearly a year, over 300 days, which gives them a lot of time to have some different digestive problems. We're seeing issues with liver abscesses. We are hoping that putting these cattle through a stocker phase on forage-based diets will shorten the time on feed and hopefully decrease some of those issues, just because they won't be in feed yards for as long a period of time. They'll be bigger, they'll be more mature, better able to handle the stresses that they see through the production phase. So we feel, you know, all the advantages of a stocker program in the beef industry should apply to these beef on dairy crosses.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Most of the rest of the country, the focus is on the dry side of the equation. Nowhere is that more true than the Southeast, which has seen a remarkable flash drought developing over the last several weeks.
Brad Rippey is a meteorologist with USDA.
We are now seeing topsoil moisture values 50% or greater in 8 southeastern states, led by Alabama at 90%, Louisiana not far behind at 89%, Mississippi 83%. Meanwhile, we're continuing to watch patchy dryness across the Great Plains and Western Corn Belt. In the hard red winter wheat areas of the Great Plains, that continues to be a concern for a portion of the winter wheat crop. Leading the Great Plains this week, Kansas 68%, very short to short on topsoil moisture. Colorado next at 55%. And that dryness extends into parts of the Western Corn Belt. Iowa leads the Midwest this week at 55%. In the Northwest, we have seen improving conditions.